You know, I was going to tell you about the Metis people not being treated right just for a bit of land here. That's mm-hmm. all they demanded.
Yeah.
And here, I have a RM Tecumseh number 65 here.
Homesteader's
map.
Mm-hmm.
And in that very map of one municipality,
mm-hmm.
they give the CPR 141 sections of land in that one, mm-hmm. and they're all in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells you. And mm-hmm. here is where Ambrose Lapine,
mm-hmm.
Ambrose Lapine is, had land,
oh, yeah. mm-hmm.
and his wife is buried there at Forget. Mm-hmm. I went to see this.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, anyway, they could afford to give 141 sections of land mm-hmm. in one municipality.
Mm-hmm.
That 141 sections was more land than they'd have given to all the half-breeds that were along mm-hmm. the river.
Sure. Together.
And the Hudson's Bay's got some land, right?
Oh, yeah, Hudson's Bay have some. But just the CPR,
CPR was the largest landholding company in the West anyway.
Yeah, and that's in one municipality. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine in the West here how much the railroads got.
Oh, of course. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And here all we were asking was mm-hmm. a few river lots.
Yeah, yeah.
Ambrose Lapine there, you see, is the man that was was leader in Winnipeg in
1697.
Yeah,
they came over to here in 1882?
Maxim did, but mm-hmm. not Ambrose. Mm-hmm. Ambrose stayed in Winnipeg. Quite a few families, in fact, the Bushes, the Richards,
mm-hmm.
they came from Winnipeg to the West here because mm-hmm. they figured
that they wouldn't go as far, and then the same happened again, of course,
yeah.
15 years later, you know.
The same had happened
exactly
before.
The same. What yeah. happened in Manitoba yeah. happened again 15 years
later. That's the way, and somewhere or another, I got hold of this, so I'm keeping hold, I'm keeping it because anybody that tells me that I'm not telling the truth or I'm wrong or something, I can prove that they did give that land when they wouldn't even give that land to the Metis people.
Yeah.
And all they were demanding was the rights to these. Metis people weren't treated right. I suppose that maybe they. Government, I suppose, figured, well, those people are not farmers, they won't open up. They still were the ones that opened the bloody land up. These guys come over here and then they'd hire us for small wages,
mm-hmm.
and we done the work.
You were the reserve cheap labor.
Yeah, so, mm-hmm. but we made a living anyway,
mm-hmm.
and we outlived a hell of a lot of them.
You're doing a good job doing that.
So anyway, that's the way it was. They were satisfied to live the way they were. They were alive, they were mm-hmm. satisfied. Either that we didn't know any better, or I didn't. Under this, we grab and take from others, we're depriving somebody of something to make ourselves rich. We'd all be rich, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
It don't seem like like the thing. And now I just forget what the hell, because I figured you fellas were going to, we just,
it's not working very well when it's sitting on the table.
Oh.
Because it's too far away from you. And it,
is that right?
Well, it's okay now. Uh-huh. I think this will be okay. Because it switches off if there's a break.
Oh, I see.
If it's too slow. Just switch it on up full time.
Oh, I see. That was, I mean, it's meant to be this way.
Yeah, it's meant to be that way.
Oh,
it's okay.
It's turning now.
Yeah, it's working.
Okay.
And what does Howard have to say? Does he talk to you fellas like a half-breed and his way of writing? He wants, I understand he's writing a book again, isn't he?
He is writing a book and he's writing articles. He wants to do, I think, a large book on Métis history. And, well, you know his Prison of Grass.
Yeah.
That book. That's a very good book. I think it's a very good book, wouldn't you agree? And, I was very successful with that. I learned a lot from Howard down in Davis. We talked a lot together.
Well, you see, he was he went to high school here, but then after he quit high school, then he left, because then his parents weren't living a way that he could have ever got to be a professor if he'd have stayed with them, because the rest of the family, they made a living, he wanted to go for education, so that's...
His brother still lives around here, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And who was the... As I came in, when I went to get this stuff out of the car, there was this gentleman who left, and we shook hands and talked a little, and he told me that he lived down that way, but I don't remember his name. What's his name?
That lame fellow that was here.
Yeah.
That's Clovis Rene.
Clovis Rene.
Yeah, R-E-G, capital R-E-G-N-I-E-R.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's going to be leaving us, the bugger. He's a good old worker. He's worked hard all his life, but his family has all moved out of St. Louis. There's some in Edmonton, and he's got a daughter in Lloydminster, so his wife wants to move to the family, so they're leaving us.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it's too bad, because he was born and raised around this neighborhood. He lived about 8 miles west of here. That's where I lived for quite a few years, up in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all half-breed people, pretty well.
What neighborhood is that?
Well, they call that Lecoq District.
Lecoq?
Capital L-E-C-O-U, C-O-Q.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
like the rooster?
Lecoq, yeah. Rick May Cock, eh? Capital L-E-C-O-Q. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was the district we lived in for quite a few years. That was where Maxime Lapine lived. That's where he had his river lot.
Oh, yeah.
It was along the river.
Was all this section in river lots?
This,
St. Louis as well?
This year, the village was in sections.
Mm-hmm.
But west, a half a mile from here, you start in river lots.
And is that still, are there still river lots like that?
Yeah.
And people live on them?
Well, not as much as it used to be. It used to be that there was a family pretty well on every river lot.
Mm-hmm.
But now you go sometimes 2-3 miles or without anybody living on there.
But you could still see the kind of structure of the river lot there, you know?
Well, you see, you can, I can tell you exactly where all the river lots are, but a stranger will go driving along, and sometimes one farmer has 2 or 3 river lots.
Right,
so they're all in one field.
Would they be Métis farmers?
There is the first few along here, the Bushy families. There's one, two, there's 3 Bushy families, descendants of the old timers yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you start to run into the French people, old country French.
Mm-hmm.
And they came from France. Their descendants came from France. But these young fellows owned the rest of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you go 5 miles west, then there's a Belgian family, the Bigrands. And they have quite a bit of land. They've bought a lot of this land. In fact, they're the ones that have them 2 river lots that we had.
Uh-huh.
We opened up this land. We had, when we left this place, there was 150 acres broke on it.
Oh.
And they
That was when your father had to leave?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The first time you were talking.
Yeah, not the first time. The first time he lived over here by the village.
2 miles down, yeah.
And the first time we only lived a half a mile here, but in them days, maybe he had 5 or 6 acres broken. Mm-hmm. He didn't have much anyway, 10 acres maybe.
What was it? What was the unbroken land like? Was the unbroken land, what was that like? Were there trees or was it grass? Or?
Well, in them olden days, they only farmed the prairie little part of it. They wouldn't go to work and open up land.
Oh, yeah.
No.
But wouldn't there still be bushes on the land and stuff like that?
Well, it wasn't that. There was bush, but like I say, wherever there was bush, they'd leave the bush.
Oh, yeah. Even the bush, I see.
But they'd leave the bush there. But they'd only farm the little prairie part of it.
No, what I was trying to imagine, what did this land look like before people came and cut down trees and opened it for farming? Was it mainly covered with trees and little patches of prairie, or?
Yeah, there was quite a lot of brush, it seems. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In my days, anyway, there was more brush than open
land.
That's
what I was thinking. So yeah. when you were young, there must have been large forests or large parts of bush and probably a lot of game. Huh?
Oh, yes, there was game. There was quite a few, there were jumpers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do quite a bit of hunting. And
jumpers? What is that, deer?
A jumper is that's deer.
Deer.
Uh-huh.
You call them jumpers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but there was no elk in this part.
Mm-hmm.
There was no moose.
No moose.
I remember that the old fellas that was when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
They had spotted three moose come into the area,
mm-hmm.
and of course, naturally, these hunters, they had to kill them.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So they got the three moose there that strayed into there.
You know so much of your own history. Would the younger people also know still a bit about the history?
You mean the younger people?
Yeah.
Today. There's not that many interested like I was.
But you would, I mean, would there people like yourself telling stories to the younger people? Would they tell them how it was, or?
No. You take like myself, if I'd only knew what I went through in the last 30 years, well, since the 30s, more than that, 40 or 50 years, if I'd only knew. And if I'd only knew that I'd have been questioned so much as I had been in the year 85, the time of the celebration in Badosh, well, they used to come in here with big, they'd put me on TV and they'd talk to me and everything. If I'd only knew that was going to happen to me,
mm-hmm.
I would have questioned, because I lived with my grandmother.
Yeah. Sure,
the wife
sure.
of Maxime Lapine.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I lived 14 years with her.
Yeah. Isn't that a shame when you realize that some knowledge is gone and you can't ask the people anymore?
Well,
I never asked my grandfather, and I regret that.
No. Well, you see, this is the bad part of it, because we didn't know that this would be such important history.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
We just grew up, and we grew up, mm-hmm. and we didn't know. But then in the 30s, when these times got tough, and we were still classed as half-breeds. We lived together, and times were hard, and the governments, well, they were the same as they are now. They tried to always keep from helping as much as they could. They figured that they were giving you too much by giving you a few fish and mm-hmm. a little bit of this and that. So anyway, then is when I pretty well have to say that I started the group.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to talk together, and we said we should organize.
Mm-hmm.
The Metis people should organize, and we call it the Metis Society.
Mm-hmm.
And we organized so that when we'd go to the council or to the government, mm-hmm. well, then we could demand more, because we were together.
Mm-hmm. Was that in the 30s, you said?
Yes.
It was the Saskatchewan Metis Association, or what is it?
Well, we call it the Metis Society.
Metis Society.
Mm-hmm.
Metis Society of Saskatchewan.
Yeah,
other people at the same time also tried to organize. Like there was the Society of American Indians in the U.S. They also organized at that time, but it broke down again. And then they tried it again. So.
Because our society, you know, it done pretty good. We helped a few people, and
how many were you?
Well, when we started, there were some maybe 50 of us, mm-hmm. I suppose.
From St. Louis?
No, I was living in that Lecoq district.
Yeah,
that's where we were living,
mm-hmm.
and in that area, these people in St. Louis. Well, you know, it happened that the farmers, the Metis farmers, were living as good as the rest because they were farming and they were having hard times, but they were still living not too bad. But us people up west, we kind of dependent on, well, what they call, it wasn't, was it welfare? I thought there was another word for it. But anyway, you know, we were living on that, but I was fortunate enough that I always tried to earn my living, and I could get to work from some of these farmers, like French people there, and like this Belgian family I told you, they were already organized enough, they could hire us guys to do the work for them, eh? So, anyway,
the media society.
Yeah, well, you see, and there, well, we managed to get started by maybe 15 of us, but we went to, we got some of the Batoche people along with us because we were in the same municipality. So we got these guys together, and but like I said, I was fortunate that I worked. I was only on welfare for 1.5 years of my life. And I paid them back. I don't owe the government one penny. What I do, I go and work on the road allowances, cutting brush, to pay back my welfare. And I was fortunate in a way. They'd give me 30 cents an hour to pay back my welfare. We used to get $15 a month of welfare. So it, at 30 cents an hour, I would work 10 hours a day, so I, in 5 days I'd pay for my month's welfare. So I don't owe them nothing, I don't owe the government nothing. Nobody can tell me, oh yeah, you lived on welfare, we had to feed you, to be damned to feed me. They, I earned my living.
No, sure.
Was there ever an attempt, or did people ever try to get together with a farm workers union?
No, no, not in my days.
Not in your
no,
days?
No, in my time. We just organized this Meta Society of Saskatchewan, and we used to ask the municipality for help and things like that. And they started up a camp. And there, in this camp, they used to get us to work to pay for our welfare. But I didn't work there very much. I did go and work a few days in the bush, but I done a lot of it by cutting brush. But in this camp, I'm telling you, these poor guys, they'd go on strike and all this kind of stuff. Now, if they'd have been in them camps, there was a big, long barn, and that's where the men stayed and slept in there. And it wasn't like to these days, you know, in the winter it's 30 below, it was real cold. Them days, many a morning it was 40 and 50 below, and we had to go to work and cut bush. And they lived in that and laid on straw and had a few blankets, a couple of blankets, some of them. They'd bring their own blankets. And that's the way we were living them days in the 30s. And I'm telling you, it was tough.
Who put the men in the camp? Or did they organize that?
The IRM of St. Louis organized this camp. And they organized this camp, and it was, in a sense, I think, to make it look like they were helping the people. But if they didn't start this camp, as I can see it now, they'd have had to feed us anyway regardless.
Sure.
But we thought we were getting a favor by working for the RM. We cut wood and hauled it out, and I'm not sure how many cords of wood we hauled out, but I, oh, there was, you know, there was a two winters, I believe, is when they cut wood. And they hauled out about 1,500 cords of wood, as I remember. And they had that in piles, you know, in rows. And I happened to be living about a mile north, well, mile and a half north of this bush camp there, where the wood was corded. And one Sunday morning, I seen a smoke, and a big black smoke up there. And so, by golly, you know, I thought there's something going on up there. There's a fire. And so I told the wife, I said, I'm going to go up there and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. Well, she said, don't be too long. She wanted to go to visit her mums. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I went up there. And when I got up there, the bloody wood was all on fire. So the wind and the fire, it was in the spring of the year, and in the spring of the year, the farmers used to burn their land so that the bush mm-hmm. would mm-hmm. burn, and then they could open enough land. And as I could see, the fire had come from down there, and they had little fire, it was to stop the fire breaks or whatever. Oh, yeah. A few furrows of land around, mm-hmm. they plowed mm-hmm. a few furrows around yeah. this yeah. way. So here, it had jumped that, of course, and mm-hmm. once it jumped that, it got into the grass and it started burning,
sure.
and the wood was nice and dry. So it was, and if you think I didn't work, I started to fight fire, and I'd cut a cord of mm-hmm. you see, it was 4 foot wood, eh? Mm-hmm. And I'd cut the cord of wood there, and I'd throw it, and then I'd go to the next one and throw it, and I, by the time I had went like that, there was, I believe, about, oh, there must have been 12 to 15 cords of wood. And then sometimes the fire would keep going back in the grass, and it would start again, and I had to fight that. I fought fire till 3 o'clock in the afternoon before I beat it, and I saved about half of that wood. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't happen to go there, there wouldn't have been one stick of wood left.
Yeah.
And to make it better, after this was done, all at once I got the visit of the RCMP. They come and wanted a statement of what had happened. And in the long run, by golly, they kind of wanted to make believe that I had set the bloody wood afire. After I had fought all day, and I saved about half of their bloody wood. Mm. That's the thanks I got for it.
From the RCMP.
So
you'll love them. Howard loves them, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's the way it was. And but they didn't do nothing because they couldn't. Everybody figured that I wouldn't do such a thing. I was classed as a pretty good neighbor. So. Anyway, but I had. But you know, with my big mouth, the cop would question me, and I would talk, mm-hmm. and they would write down. And after they were all finished, they got me to sign my name, and I signed my bloody name on this paper. So, but I always remember that after I had fought all day, and my wife was so worried, she didn't know what the hell had happened to me. Mm-hmm. I had left to come back, mm-hmm. and here I wasn't coming back. Mm-hmm. So she went up to her mother's, she walked, it was about 2.5 miles, and when she got over there was somebody told her, Midrick just come, and he was fighting fire all day. So, but them days I could work, I could fight fire. But nowadays, well, we have to give in to everything. But it was a pretty tough living in them days, I tell you. I went through that. I got kicked out of homes and everything. And that's why I'm not a capitalist, is because I don't approve of that damn system.
No.
And I think I have good reasons.
There's another thing I want to ask you. You mentioned the road allotments. The road allotments.
Yeah.
And I read in some book, I think it was in Maria Campbell's book, Half-Breed, where she says that for some time they were living on the road allotments. I don't know what the road allotments are and how it relates to Métis people. Maybe you can explain that.
Well, rodel, you see what we, you said allotment, but we say allowance, road allowance.
Road allowance, okay. I don't know anything about that.
Oh, okay. Well, you see what would happen, eh? The road allowance is a municipal road.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes a road allowance will maybe go to the river like that, and it's a...
Is that a wide strip of land?
It's about 66 feet wide.
66 feet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not that wide.
No,
it's 22 steps. Mm-hmm. It's 22 steps across.
Oh, yeah.
But you see, sometimes this piece of road will go lead you to a place where it's of no use to nobody. So we call that just a shack up. We'd build a shack there and live there, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because there, nobody could come and say, move off of there.
Yeah.
It wasn't on their place. It was on the road allowance.
Yeah.
So that's where some people live, on road allowance. Yeah. They,
what happened to them eventually? Are there still people living on road
allowance? No, not now.
So they were, what, moved or evicted? Or?
Well, more or less the people moved away from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because right now I wouldn't know of anybody living on a road allowance.
Mm-hmm.
No. But in them days, well, you see, that's what they called... staying on road allowances.
Mm-hmm.
They'd move there, and once they moved there, well, it didn't matter who owned the land on the other side, they didn't usually move them away from there.
Yeah. So were there a lot of Métis people living on road allowances?
Not in this area.
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
Not in this area, but I understand that in some places where they were living on road allowances more than here.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you see, it happened that the Métis people in 82 took up all the land along here.
Yeah.
And those that was fortunate enough to keep opening up their land and working, they stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, in fact, from here to Batoche, there's nobody living there now, but there was only two or three maybe lived on road allowances,
mm-hmm.
but not many.
Mm-hmm.
They had their own land, like, well, they had taken some of this land up as homesteads, maybe,
mm-hmm.
because I know that there were some homesteads. But in my time, in this neighborhood, there was no homesteads no more because the land was all taken already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would there still be a lot of young people living here in St. Louis today?
Pardon?
Would there still be a lot of young people living in St. Louis nowadays?
Nowadays?
Yeah.
There's quite a few.
So it's not that they would all go into the cities or so, no?
No, there is quite a few. In fact, it's mostly Métis people that are living.
That's what I think.
There's the Richards and the McDougalls and a few families like this. They work in the city.
They work in the city, but they would live here.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So
when you say the
commute.
City, it's
St. Albert.
Prince Albert.
Yeah. It's about 20 miles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's because there's a very little work in a village like this.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering.
So they commute. They go there every day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they would all basically speak French, right?
No.
No. Is it more English nowadays than French?
We're losing our language. I and the wife never talk English.
You would speak French.
We always talk French.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandchildren
mm-hmm.
talk English.
Do they understand French?
Some of them don't.
Oh, yeah.
They come here with their mother, like I got a daughter living here in town, and she comes and visits, and her daughter is about 8, maybe 10. But anyway, if she comes with her mother, my wife talks French to her daughter. And sometimes these little kids, they go and they'll ask their mother, what's grandma saying? What's grandma saying? They want to know what grandma's saying, but grandma keeps talking French quite a bit. She does talk English, but mostly we talk French.
Would they learn about Luriel in school?
In 85, there was some talk about Luriel.
Mm.
Yeah. But
usually not.
Well, in my days, I never learned about Louisville at school.
Oh. And nowadays, with the young children?
Well, like I say, there's the history. For a while, there was a little more about the half-breed people in Louisville.
Mm-hmm. But that was in 85.
But that was in 85, of course, yeah, because of the celebration.
The celebration of 100 years.
Yes, but yeah. What? How now? I mean, is it...
There is maybe sometimes a subject, it seems to me, and some learn it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there's much said about the half-breed people.
Yeah. So it would be people like yourself who sort of tell the grandchildren or teach the grandchildren?
Well, it happens like even the white people, like we have a French-speaking people, the Godets here, and their daughter was taken as the subject or whatever. Nowadays, of course, I don't know just how it works at school. I haven't been
attentive.
But this young girl wanted to write about Louis Riel, so she come and talk to me about that. Mm-hmm. And
that was a school project.
It must have been, yeah, because she wanted to study that because she was at school and she was taking that as a subject.
Do you know how old she was or what grade?
Well, she was taking high school anyway.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Let's see, yeah, but it's in a way it shows, you know.
It's a shame though, if you are not around to tell.
If you were not here, nobody would know.
Well, they'd have to, then they'd have to look into the books.
Yeah,
like certain books, like you said, Maria Campbell, she had a book, and then there's different ones that wrote a bit about the Metis people, and so
Howard did too.
Oh yes, Howard took up his.
I guess that's why he came to see you, huh?
Well, he you see, when before he left here, he used to be kind of interested in the way I was acting a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so after he was gone, well, naturally, if he'd come around, he'd always come and visit his Uncle Midrick.
Sure.
So, but Howard has always been interested in that, in the history of the half-breed people, it seems, because let's see now, what year would that be? In 60, maybe in 66, I think it was. He ran, and he was elected president of the Metis Society. But he didn't stay very long. He was at the head of the society for maybe a couple of years. Not sure now. But then he wanted a leave of absence for a year, and he went to school in Vancouver. And then when he come back, then Jim Sinclair was the president, and Howard didn't run against him, but he run as West Central Area Director, and he got elected. And if he would have stayed, and if he didn't go to the States, and stayed and run against Jim Sinclair, I'm sure he got elected again in the near future. But he left and went to the States because Jim Sinclair was a non-status Indian.
Oh, yeah.